A note for listeners, this episode contains discussion of suicide. Please listen with caution and care.
So, Jason, I've been working on this one episode about a man who went to prison when he was 14 years old, an adult prison, and just thinking about, you know, what a child growing up in that kind of environment, what that does to them.
Yeah. You think about it. I mean, a 14-year-old, that's a child. You're in eighth grade,
right?
Maybe ninth grade. I mean, it's unimaginable to take a child and put them in a situation that is the most adult of adult nightmares.
Yeah. I mean, so just even the concept that we interrogate children, especially, you know, when police are allowed to lie to them.
That is a Shakespearean type of a scenario, right? And of course, we know that young people are much more likely to confess to crimes that they didn't commit because they're so susceptible to the tricks and the lies and even physical or psychological abuse that they endure, you know.
I was in a panic, but yet I was still aware that I didn't do what they're saying that I did. And I stuck to that, even though they were threatening me with life in prison. And you know what happens to kids that go to prison? I never wavered from anything that I ever said.
From Lava for Good, this is Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Today, Michael Poli. As dawn broke on December 5th, 1998, 14-year-old Mike Poliet woke up to the smell of something burning. His friend Josh was sleeping over, and when they opened his bedroom door, they were inundated with smoke. Mike and Josh scrambled to crawl out of the house to escape. On the way, Mike stopped by his mother's room to check on her. What he saw scarred him forever. Rita Poliet was laying on the floor, face up with her legs spread open, with just a pair of underwear on. Her body was on fire. 39-year-old Rita Poliet was dead. Josh ran to a neighbor's to call 911, while Mike tried to put the fire out with a hose. When the police showed up, they immediately made it clear that Mike was the prime suspect in his mother's murder. Despite other suspects linked more closely with the evidence at hand, including his own father, Mike was arrested, charged, and convicted for the murder of his mother.
And then at that point, that's when he said, "Is your father responsible for what happened?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Did you see him?" I said, "No." He said, "Did you hear anything?" I said, "No, I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything." But he's the only one that I know that would hate her that much to do that to her. And what I seen was evil. It was hatred.
Michael Poliet was born in Mineral Point, Missouri. He grew up in a poor family. He lived with his parents, Rita and Ed Poliet, and his siblings in a trailer in the village.
I was a pretty happy kid growing up. Kindergarten through fifth grade, right? I was on honor roll, straight A student, loved to go to school. I was outgoing. I was always with my friends, riding bicycles, four wheelers, motorcycles.
Mike is the youngest of three kids. His sister Crystal is the oldest, and then there's Melanie, who's 7 years older than him. Here's Melanie.
So when he was little, he wasn't a terrible kid. He was just, you know, he was rambunctious fun, liked to like play outside, and he had good friends. They weren't ever in like real bad trouble. I was always his babysitter. Crystal didn't ever have to do anything because she was the oldest, so she got to go out with her friends, do whatever. I was always the one stuck at home babysitting Mike. And at the time, I'm like, I hated it. But now I'm like, I'm so glad that happened because, you know, if it didn't, would we be this close? I don't know. I would like to hope that we would be, but you never know.
Mike remembers being especially close with his mom, Rita.
My mom got me into sports. Right? She played softball when she was younger, gave me my first ball glove. She'd always organize practices in our yard, and she'd have all the kids over, and we'd practice playing.
He always took up for our mom, like, with kids at school, you know, back in the day, around this time, they were always telling your mama jokes.
Mm-hmm,
like, your mama's so fat, blah,
yep.
blah, whatever. Oh, well, somebody did that to him, and he was very upset about it. And he was like, you better never talk about my mother. He almost got in a fight with this kid. And it was like, you know, okay, it's a joke, but that's how sensitive he is about our mom, you know? Like, you just don't mess with her.
Mike's dad, Ed, also had a special place in Mike's heart, and he helped foster one of his passions, racing cars.
You know, I looked up to him quite a bit. My dad raced stock cars at the local dirt track. Made me want to do, you know? Every Saturday night, as a child, I remember going to the races. And really, it's been a childhood dream of mine to actually race a late model. I look forward to that in the future. But growing up, it was good up until the point where our family dynamics began to change because of infidelity on my father's part.
Yeah, there was definitely some physical violence, a lot of arguing, a lot of mental abuse from my dad to my mom. He also did it to us too, you know, like guilt trips, and he would always talk bad about our mom to us. Don't know why. That's definitely not good parenting.
Mike's and Melanie's dad was also pretty absent. He worked nights at the Ford Motor plant, and so Mike and his sisters rarely saw him home. Melanie says her mom was really the one who raised them and took care of them.
She was the one going to all of our games and all of our school functions and Mike's, and all of ours. You know, our dad never went. You know, he could have went to days if he really wanted to spend time with his family, I'm sure, but he always just chose to work nights at Ford, which we were okay with, because honestly, we didn't like him being around anyway, because he was always cranky and he always had the TV, so... That's when we were kids. Like, dad's going to be home. Oh, great. Now we're going to have to leave for the whole weekend because nobody wants to be around him.
Mike's parents divorced when he was young. His mom did not hide the reason why.
I guess she recorded a phone conversation with him and another woman. And my mom played it for me and both my sisters. And she said, this is why I'm leaving your father. And we asked him, and he denied it. He denied that was even him on the line. And I think it was that moment that I realized that he probably wasn't who I thought he was.
It was around this time as a preteen that Mike started acting out.
I kind of used the divorce and my parents' separation as a crutch as far as my bad behavior. I would always turn to that and be like, well, it's their fault because they're getting divorced, and people sympathize with it, so it kind of like helped me get an out of getting into trouble with them. So it kind of made me feel like that I can, you know, be as mischievous as I wanted to be, really.
So what kinds of things would you do?
Well, we set a lot of fires, me and my friends. I became somewhat of a bully at school. I remember once my cousin's truck, we throw oranges and tomatoes, and we stomped on the hood of it and hit it with golf clubs and baseball bats. And I ended up stealing CDs from like Walmart. That was about the extent of bad behavior.
And not only did Mike's bad behavior escalate during the divorce, but so did his father Ed's behavior.
I remember a few violent arguments where they would throw like pots and pans at each other and stuff like that. It only happened like twice that I remember when I was young. But as we got older, we only really witnessed like the yelling and the arguments. Mike, unfortunately, got to witness the actual violence.
I remember specifically they were arguing over a sunflower clock that a coworker gave to her that he wouldn't let her have it. And the argument became thumps. And I grabbed the baseball bat that was in my room. I ran out of my room. They were in the living room. And he was on top of her. I told him to get off of her. He did. And my mom got up. And as we were leaving, she grabbed a picture of his girlfriend and off the wall, put it on the ground, stomped on it. We left. During their divorce proceedings, I actually testified against my father about this incident. It was those moments like that it pushed me further away from my father. Right? And it's those moments that I remember that take me back to when I seen my mother burning on the floor. It's easy for me to to come to the conclusion of who's responsible for it.
On December 4th, 1998, Mike's mom, Rita, went out with her friends. One of her friends remembers 14-year-old Mike calling and saying he was hungry. So on her way home around 11:30 p.m., Rita stopped to get Subway sandwiches. Mike had invited his friend Josh to stay over that night. While the boys waited for Rita to come home with food, boys being boys, they went and burned railroad ties on the railroad tracks near the house. Shortly after midnight, Rita got home. Soon after the boys ate, they all went to bed. Mike's sister Melanie was 21 at the time. She also lived in the trailer, but she was over at a friend's house that night. In the early hours of December 5th, as light was just beginning to appear, Mike woke to the smell of smoke.
I woke up, and either I smelled or I seen smoke. And I looked down at Josh, and I asked him if he was smoking a cigarette.
Josh was not. At this point, the trailer was filling with smoke, and they had to get out. Mike and Josh crawled to escape. On the way, Mike stopped at his mom's room to check on her. To his horror, he found Rita burning on the ground. She was face up, her legs spread open, and was only wearing a pair of underwear. Mike and Josh both ran out of the house, Josh to the neighbors and Mike to get the hose. Around 6:30 a.m., police and first responders arrived to the ghastly scene. Rita's body was burned from her pubic region to her head. Immediately, Mike and Josh were separated into different squad cars and taken to the station for questioning. Detective Kurt Davis took Mike.
When he was transporting me from my home to the sheriff's department that morning, I asked him, is he going to be able to find out what happened to my mom? He says, what do you mean, what happened to your mom? Well, what happened, like if her throat was cut or something, you guys going to be able to tell that?
This conversation was later used against Mike in court.
And they used that as an indication that I was concerned that they were going to find out what I did, right? Instead of being a concerned 14-year-old kid who just witnessed a horrible thing.
This episode is underwritten by AIG, a leading global insurance company. AIG is committed to corporate social responsibility and to making a positive difference in the lives of its employees and in the communities where we work and live. In light of the compelling need for pro bono legal assistance and in recognition of AIG's commitment to criminal and social justice reform, the AIG Pro Bono Program provides free legal services and other support to underrepresented communities and individuals.
Mike essentially became the prime suspect within moments of this crime.
This is Megan Crane. She's the co-director of the Missouri Office of the MacArthur Justice Center, a civil rights organization. And she thinks Mike immediately became a suspect because of presumptions around the circumstances.
I mean, I think the basic premise probably was that he was the only family member home at the time. And in arson cases, that is the first person who's looked at who else was in the home, particularly if it's a family member who survived the fire. So he's already under the spotlight for that fact. But for there, things quickly spiraled out of control because the police mischaracterized him. They saw this kid who was traumatized, shocked, and they misjudged all of his reactions, his behaviors, as evidence of guilt, as evidence of a lack of remorse, as evidence of a cold-blooded killer, rather than evidence of adolescent behavior, which research proves is common to all kids his age, and evidence of trauma.
So after the police picked you up, they pretty quickly homed in on you and you were arrested very quickly. What was going through your head, you know, when you're in this interrogation?
The interrogations were very intense. There was, on occasions, there was multiple interrogators. There was a fire marshal. There was Kurt Davis, who was the lead detective. And then also the juvenile officers who were supposed to be there to protect me and Josh's rights were also asking them questions. They used the same line of questioning over and over and over. And I relayed the same set of facts over and over and over.
So tell me, like, what were they asking repeatedly?
They were asking what happened. Take me through the day before, that evening, that morning. And it became a point where they were trying to convince me, right, that I'd done something. And I know that I didn't do anything.
Mike says every time he got to the part where he woke up and found his mom, they would tell him he was missing a big gap and ask him what happened between the time he went to sleep and when he woke up and found his mom. Tell it again, over and over.
It went for hours. And my understanding, they treated Josh the same way. And they would tell me that he's telling on me. And they would tell him that I'm telling on him. Tactics that shouldn't be used on juveniles, on children, for sure. But they completely ignored the fact that our statements never changed. And throughout all these interrogations, there's 26 consistencies between our statements. And that doesn't happen of two kids that are lying about something or trying to hide something, right? And they completely ignored all of this information.
Back at the crime scene, Officer Tammy Belfield had arrived and almost immediately was told by Sheriff Ron Skiles that a woman had intentionally been set on fire. Fire investigator Jim Holdman had concluded without any testing that a fire accelerant had been poured on Rita. The autopsy also determined that Rita had died of carbon monoxide poisoning and sustained blunt force trauma to her head. Two baseball bats, a fire poker, and a maglite flashlight were collected to see if one was the weapon used to hit Rita. But when tested later, these items returned no results.
I mean, what was going through your head where you were like, this isn't real? Like, what were you thinking? You're like a little boy.
I was in a panic. I was in a panic, but yet I was still aware that I didn't do what they're saying that I did. And I stuck to that. Even though I was in a panic, even though they were threatening me with life in prison, and you know what happens to kids that go to prison, I never wavered from anything that I ever said.
Because Mike was a juvenile at the time, a juvenile officer was present during this interrogation, and his dad, Ed, was called in to be with him since Mike couldn't be questioned alone. But Megan says Mike really did lack critical support.
He did not have an attorney present. The people that were there, I guess, to arguably protect his rights were, one, a juvenile officer who was there for some of the interrogation. But the record makes clear that this juvenile officer acted essentially as another interrogator, not in any way as a protector of his rights. And Mike's dad, who was indisputably at that point the other prime suspect in this case. So he had a clear conflict of interest in that interrogation room and was not an adequate protective figure for Mike.
Which seems obvious given Ed's nasty, violent divorce from Rita, but law enforcement didn't seem to consider this, nor did they consider how his presence might impact Mike. And in fact, Mike was uncomfortable answering questions with Ed in the room.
When they were interrogating me, they asked me, who do you think murdered your mother? My father was like right beside me during these interrogations. And Kirk Davis asked me, do you want me to ask your father to step out? I said, yeah. And then at that point, that's when he said, is your father responsible for what happened? I said, yes. He said, did you see him? I said, no. He said, did you hear anything? I said, no, I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. But he's the only one that I know that would hate her that much to do that to her. And what I seen was evil. It was hatred.
But the cops didn't listen. Mike was interrogated for 2 days. And during that time, he was also hooked up to a CVSA, a computer voice stress analysis test, which is different from a lie detector test. This test supposedly detects deception by measuring stress levels in the voice.
They hooked a microphone up to my shirt, put something on my finger, and they asked me, I think it was like 5 basic questions. Did you murder your mother? I said, no. Do you know anybody that would want to hurt your mother? I said, no. Did you hear anybody? Did you hear anything? I said, no. And there may have been one or two more. I can't remember. But ultimately, they told me that I failed.
Meaning that the test showed he was lying. And we can't corroborate whether Mike failed this stress test since we don't have those results ourselves. Not that it really matters, though, because these voice stress tests, which were frequently used by law enforcement during the 90s, have since been determined to be wholly unreliable. And even if they were reliable, it would have been no surprise that Mike had failed. Because what we do know is that Mike was a 14-year-old boy distraught after finding his mom brutally murdered, that Mike's interrogations were not recorded, and that police officers did not properly look into Ed as a suspect.
They think we can build a case against this kid. Ed was a savvier suspect, and he arguably had an alibi. They did some investigation into him, not much, but the investigation they did do had more hurdles than their case they were building against Mike. So I think they went with the easier target, the easier case to build. Ed supposedly had this alibi that he was at work, but there are no time cards from Ford Motor Company proving that. Ed was not held like accountable to be there at all times. And even if he left at the time that his shift supposedly ended, there still was time to make that drive to Hopewell and back. So his alibi was never rock solid.
On December 7th, Mike was arrested for the murder of his mother, Rita Polite.
They arrest him on his lack of emotion and suspicious reaction to his mother's death.
When Mike was arrested, laboratory testing on the items collected, the baseball bats, flashlight, and poker, had not yet returned results. And after the testing was ultimately completed, nothing pointed to accelerant as the fire starter.
And I woke up, my entire world was just gone. I lost my mother. I lost my sisters. I lost myself. Like, everything was gone.
So had you guys ever thought about wrongful convictions before? Like, was that something that...
No. Never. Never. Never even thought our... Never crossed our mind that something like that happened. No, never would I have ever thought that wrongful convictions happened until they really did, like, arrest him and take him to jail and not let him out.
Mike was sent to a juvenile detention facility to await trial. 3 days after the murder, a hearing was held to determine whether to keep Mike detained. And despite the court concluding the case was thin and circumstantial at best, Mike remained in custody.
It felt like the only person that would have helped me in that situation was my mother.
Yeah.
And she was no longer with us. So with that, I felt completely alone, completely isolated, completely vulnerable, and I didn't know how to handle it.
Exactly 1 month after his arrest, Mike attempted suicide.
I was having problems adjusting to it and handling it. And I had enough, I guess. And I tried to hang myself in my cell.
Mike tied a sheet to the vent and hung himself from it. Fortunately, a guard walked by and saved his life. Melanie recalls how her little brother looked when he was arrested.
Just looking at him, you could tell he could not inflict that kind of damage on a person. He just was a small boy. He was about my size I am now, because I used to wear his clothes. And I actually have a pair of his jeans from back then that I just put on the other day, and they still fit.
But by the time his trial started in January of 2002, Mike was 18 years old, 4 years older, 4 inches taller, at 30 pounds heavier. He no longer looked like a little boy. The prosecutors were Richard Hicks, Assistant Attorney General of Jefferson City, Missouri, and John Rupp, prosecuting attorney for Washington County, Missouri. The state called 17 witnesses, which is a lot, but they presented no real evidence, only the alleged accelerant police claimed dogs had smelled on Mike's shoes, but which, remember, the lab never actually found. Before trial, the prosecution actually offered Mike a plea deal to confess. 15 years for manslaughter. he would have been out by 2017.
Did you ever consider taking that?
No, I never considered it.
Do you wish you had taken it?
Absolutely not. I'm not going to plead guilty to something I didn't do. Especially if it denies my mother justice.
All of us have a breaking point when subjected to these coercive interrogation tactics, especially kids. But Mike was desperate to know what had happened to his mom. So he did withstand this coercion over days, and he never confessed.
Now, I would rather do this for her and ultimately win in the end and make the sheriff's department and prosecutor's office prosecute the people that's responsible for what happened to her.
But even with the prosecution's weak evidence, Mike's defense was even weaker. They only called 3 witnesses, and they did not have an expert who could challenge the state's experts. The trial lasted 3 days, and after 4 hours of deliberation, on April 19th, 2002, Mike was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. During his first 4 years in prison, Mike kept in touch with his father, Ed, despite believing that he was the one responsible for his mother's murder.
Do you think that your dad intentionally tried to frame you?
That's a hard question. A part of me wants to say yes, right? Another part of me wants to think that he just got so lucky with the incompetence of the Washington County Sheriff's Department. It just happened that way. It was well known that I played with fire as a kid, and fire was used to ultimately murder my mother. I can say that he never helped. He never tried to help me. That's a 100% fact that he's never tried to help me.
Yet after Mike's direct appeal was denied, Ed told his son he was going to help him. In 2005. He told Mike that he'd hired an attorney to help with his next appeal.
He kept reaching out to the attorney, never hearing back. Finally, he got a friend to call the attorney's office. And that's when the attorney said, I haven't responded to you because we don't have an attorney-client relationship. I'm not your attorney any longer. And that's when Mike learned his father had lied to him. He'd never paid this attorney or even asked him if he would be willing to file this post-conviction petition. And that's the last time Mike and his father have ever spoke. And his sisters have not spoken to their father since then either.
This devastated Mike.
And that was when my heavy drug use came in, when I found out that I didn't have a lawyer and that he'd been misleading me for at least a year and a half about having a lawyer. And once I found out and understood the significance of not having one, it sent me into a drug-induced life, really. I mean, I left my cell. I didn't come back unless I had some heroin, cocaine, weed, something. And that was my way of coping with it.
As for Melanie, she thinks her dad never intended to help Mike from the beginning. Her feeling is that Ed likely framed Mike.
Honestly, I think he tried to set Mike up to take the fall. I mean, that sounds horrible, but honestly, those are my thoughts. He didn't care about anyone else. He only cares about himself. He's like a psychopath. I mean, like, literally. I can't even believe that we came from that. Because we don't act anything like him. It's so bizarre.
Knowing him, it doesn't surprise me. Right? Because of what I've seen in the end, how he treated my mom, how he treated us. It's something that I can honestly look at and say, you know what, it doesn't surprise me. It is what it is, right? But I don't need him.
And Mike didn't. On his own, he was able to get clean from the drugs he had used to cope. He wound up getting his GED in prison and worked with shelter dogs to rehabilitate them.
Dog program. I love the dog program. And the greatest accomplishment I feel like is that I was able to train canines for companions. The kids that have autism, right? And that is something that actually touches people on the street. It's just not an internal Department of Correction program, like something that I can actually make a difference with.
But Mike was still determined to prove his innocence. He wrote letters to every attorney and Innocence Project he could find, until one wrote back.
I wrote the MIP, 7-8-page letter. I'm sure they still have it. I explained my whole story. I mailed it.
Within a few months, Mike got a visit from Kim Blucker, a staff attorney for the MIP, which is the Midwest Innocence Project. Six law students from Missouri University and Kansas University accompanied him.
They sat down in the visiting room with me and they told me, tell us what happened. And I told them, and it changed my life. It saved my life. The expressions that I seen on those students' faces and Ken's face when I was telling my story stuck with me. And I knew that they were going to investigate everything that I just said. I knew that everything that they were going to find was factually true to everything I just said. And from that day on, I've been sober. So they saved my life in more ways than one.
When the Midwest Innocence Project took Mike's case, they filed a new petition claiming Mike is innocent based on new evidence, including the fact that Mike's shoes did not actually have an accelerant on them.
The material, the substance on Mike's shoes, which were determined to be gasoline at trial, was actually an aromatic solvent that was part of the manufacturing process of these tennis shoes. So this material was in every pair of shoes that were sold across the country, was not at all unique to Mike's pair of shoes, but was the thing that was used to convict him and send him to prison for life.
Megan says the state even concedes that this evidence is false.
Yet they are still fighting his litigation and still fighting to keep him in prison.
One of the detectives has even come forward with her own opinions on the case.
Tammy Belfield, one of the deputy sheriffs who investigated this case, who shared and confirmed that, like, this was a mess. This was a police department that was way in over its head. They did not have the experience, the resources to handle this type of case or a case of this magnitude. And they didn't know what they were doing. And to the extent they did, they did it wrong or made the wrong judgments.
Despite the new evidence, all of Mike's appeals have been denied. On October 13th, 2021, he filed another petition, quote, seeking a writ of habeas corpus, vacating his conviction for second-degree murder. Mike would have to wait months to find out if this one would also be denied. But then on February 8th of this year, Mike got a surprise. The parole board granted him an early release. A new law in Missouri, SB 26, allows certain incarcerated juveniles parole after 15 years. So in January 2022, Megan Crane and the rest of Mike's team applied for parole. And despite the difficulty of claiming innocence for parole, the board granted Mike's release. Now that Mike is finally getting out of prison, I asked him what he thinks of his suicide attempt.
Do you think back on that and you know, think that you're glad that they found you?
Yeah. Because there's only one explanation that I can draw from everything that's ever happened to me, is that, one, I'm strong enough and capable of handling everything that they throw at me. But I'm also strong enough and capable of using it for the better of society, right?
Mike, now 38, walked out of prison on April 22nd of this year. A few days after his release, we spoke again. Mike was at Melanie's house, surrounded by his sisters, nieces, nephews, and of course...
Yeah, we got the puppy dogs. Yeah, a blue heeler and a black lab.
Okay, so tell me how it's been being home.
It's been awesome. I ain't got much sleep. I've been running on pure adrenaline. We went to the stock car races Saturday night. I met up with some family members I ain't seen in over 2 decades. Yeah, it was awesome.
So I think, you know, one of the more incredible things about you, Mike, and what happened to you is that you were so young when you went to prison that you really grew up inside prison. And what's it like to be an adult now outside?
It's walking into an alien world, right? Because I've spent 2/3 of my life incarcerated. So that's what I knew. It's a culture shock. all the technology, the speed of everything, opening the refrigerator and seeing all the food, all the choices. I went into Walmart and I was like, what? So, and it's just so, I don't have the proper verbs to describe it, but it's just amazing.
So what do you want people to know about what happened to you and really anything? It's an open-ended question.
You know, what happened to me can happen to anybody. And there's countless more people that's suffering how I suffered, and they need help. And I look forward to being a part of that. You know, for the greatest country in the world, right? It shouldn't be this hard when it's discovered that there's innocent people or an innocent person in prison. And the Herculean hurdles that it takes to get people out and exonerated, even when it's factually proven that evidence was used against this people that's false or misleading, or if there's new discovered evidence, they don't want to hear it. They ignore it. And it's very disappointing, to say the least, that things like that happen.
Mike plans to work with Innocence Projects and use his experience to inspire the next generation of law students to help change the judicial system. But before signing off, I had one last question for him.
Have you thought about your mom a lot since you've been out?
Yeah, I think about her every day. You know, regardless if I was in there or out here, that's something we tell stories about her. Yeah.
What do you wish she could see right now?
Oh, she's smiling. Yeah, she's smiling. She knows. She can finally rest, right? I always felt that she wasn't at peace with what happened in the aftermath of what happened to her. But there was a moment when I was in the parking lot and there was two geese that flew over and honked right above me. And I just looked up and I said, "Hi, Mom." And it was just instant. Aww. Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah.
I felt like that was her celebrating.
If you'd like to help Mike get back on his feet, go to GoFundMe.com and search for Michael Poli. If you or someone you know is having thoughts of suicide, help is available. Please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. Next time on Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling, Brian Parnell.
But when they turned around and said to me, "Yeah, we have your DNA and we got your fingerprints at a crime scene. You killed this guy from Westchester." I said, "Wait a minute, you got the wrong guy."
Thank you for listening to Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling. Please support your local innocence organizations and go to the links in our bio to see how you can help. I'd like to thank our executive producers, Jason Flom, Kevin Wordis, as well as our senior producer, Annie Chelsea, researcher Lila Robinson, and story editor Sonia Paul, with additional production by Jeff Clyburn. The music in this production is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction, Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast, and on Twitter at Wrongful Conviction, as well as at Lava for Good on all three platforms. You can also follow me on both Instagram and Twitter at Maggie Freeling. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.